You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko kēsta tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Ahina Monday. I'm your host, Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Alex. E whaakane coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Laura McClure about New Zealand's stance on the US kidnapping of Venezuelan President Maduro and the ACT Party's campaign plans for 2026. I also spoke to distinguished scholar at the National Centre for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, and honorary faculty member at the Department of Physics at the University of Auckland, Kevin Tremberth, about rising ocean temperatures and the potential ramifications. Alex, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Professor Robert Patman, a senior lecturer in political science at the University of Otago, about Trump's attacks and intervention in Venezuela, and what that means for US's place in South America and the world. I also spoke with senior lecturer in computer science at the University of Auckland, Dr. Ulrich Spadel, about the Manage My Health data breach, what it means about the cybersecurity of these platforms, what leaked data means, and what should be done to protect New Zealanders' personal data.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wae mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kawa e warawara e ahena koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rokiroki mārunga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more, as always, by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party.
After United States forces kidnapped Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the New Zealand Foreign Minister Winston Peters put out a statement expressing concern over the move and his expectations that countries maintain adherence to international law. New Zealand's response has been criticised by some, who say it does not go far enough in upholding New Zealand's independent foreign policy and history of calling out infringements of international law. In our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Laura McClure, filling in this week for Simon Court. I asked about the party's stance on the developing US-Venezuela situation and about the party's campaign plans for the 2026 election. So I wanted to start off this morning with a brief discussion of the US-Venezuela situation. After the US kidnapping of Venezuelan President Maduro, there's been a range of responses internationally, including New Zealand's Foreign Minister Winston Peters expressing concern and his expectations that all parties follow international law. Does this align with the ACT Party's stance?
Yeah, look, I think it is something to be concerned about when it comes to the rules-based order, and that's something that New Zealand has specifically benefited from. But I think what I will say is that Maduro, you know, was not a legitimate leader of his country. You had many, many people fleeing from his kind of rule, and now you see them celebrating in the streets. So whatever path that led to this, and I can't really comment on another country's foreign policy and actions, I think it is a really good thing for the Venezuelans. But it is concerning that the rules-based order is being challenged and is changing, and I think that's something we need to keep a close eye on here in New Zealand.
The government has been criticised for not taking a stronger stance by some members of the opposition, including Green Party co-leader Marama Davidson, who called it a blatant breach of international law and said that staying silent betrays the values of our nation. Can we expect a stronger government response moving forward?
Look, I'm unable to comment on what the foreign minister and the government may be thinking. But look, I think we're seeing this all around the world, whether it's China, Russia. These big powers are changing the way in which that we've been seeing the geopolitical landscape for quite some time now. And I think it is New Zealand is going to have to rethink our foreign policy and some of our stances and how we approach some of these issues. So I think that's a discussion that we have to have. you know, do we need to be stronger on these things, or do we need to change outright? I mean, those are discussions that I think a lot of the parties, including ourselves, will be having in the future. But, I mean, the main point that I will make was that, you know, when you compare, say, like Putin to what happened in Ukraine, and you compare to an illegitimate president in a country that has been basically had their democracy stripped, and we believe in democracy and the free world. So to have that kind of restored, there is something good in that, in a way. But how that's actioned, I think that is a really key question. It's something that I think that a lot of the parties will be discussing in the future.
Moving towards 2026 now and back domestically, given it's an election year, do we have any insight yet into the ACT Party's plans for campaigning?
Yes, so we've got quite a lot of exciting plans underway at the moment. We are yet to obviously launch our campaign. There'll be some things that you can expect from it, like we'll always campaign on freedom of human rights, in a free society, lower taxes, less government spending or wasteful spending. But yeah, there will be a few surprises in there. And I think at the moment, this last year, we've really been out there on the ground, listening to people, finding out what actually matters to Kiwis, and how we can actually, you know, deliver on some of those things that we know New Zealanders want. And look, I think you've seen the start of the RMA reform come in at the end of that last year, and that's going to be obviously carried out over the next 6 months. That work will be happening in Parliament, and that is something that I think we can build on from there. And look, I can't give away any secrets yet. You're just going to have to wait. But yeah, you can expect the classic stuff that you'd get from ACT, and something else, I think, from there that we know that Kiwis are really concerned about, and you know, we're wanting to fix some of those issues for them.
With a record number of seats won last election by the ACT Party, are there any learnings that the party will be taking from that election moving into this year's election?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think the last election was a huge success for ACT. This is the first time that there has been this amount of ACT government ministers, and we also have a deputy prime minister. So there's been quite a lot of learnings from that, and I think the team has done extraordinarily well. And I mean, I'm slightly biased coming in from that, but it means that we, being a smaller party in government, you always run the risk that you're kind of absorbed, but we've managed to keep true to our brand. We've managed to push as hard as we can on the things that we know are important to our voters. And I'd like to think that those that lent us their vote in 2023 are pretty happy with where things have gone, because if ACT wasn't there, I know that we wouldn't have seen the things that we're seeing now, the extent we're seeing. So, look, I think there are definitely some learnings. There's things that we can build upon, but we want to maintain that momentum and just go bigger from here, really.
We've also seen over the course of this government multiple policies either backed or put forward by ACT MPs receive some strong attention in the public spotlight, you know, controversies, protests, things like the Treaty Principles Bill, things like the Regulatory Standards Bill have received a lot of attention and a lot of backlash from many people. Is the ACT Party concerned about how this will affect developing policy going forward?
Look, I think we always consider what the voter may want. I mean, we're a political party, and we're in the business of selling ideas. So that is something that we always consider. But I'm really proud of those pieces of legislation, those bills we put up, because there have been issues and there are ongoing issues. And we know our membership, we know voters, we know everyday people tell us their frustrations with us. And there's one thing that we know is true about the ACT Party is that we're not afraid to have some of these hard conversations, even if that means you're going to ignite some, you know, heated debate and emotions around it. I think it's really important for New Zealand and our democracy to have these conversations. So that is something you can always expect from us. We're not afraid to shy away from some of the more, I would say, sensitive or difficult topics. Because it's really important that we do have these discussions so that we can, you know, have the best future possible for New Zealand. Otherwise, if it's not us, it will be someone else. And I can tell you now, it's not. These are issues that are not just going to go away.
Also concerning ACT moving into this election, obviously being part of a coalition means that parties have to work together. But as we move to the election, parties tend to prioritise what sets them apart. How will the ACT Party balance these priorities of working with the coalition government, but also setting itself apart from National and New Zealand First?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I mean, that is a challenge in itself. I think what we're going to be doing is we've got quite a busy work programme, so we're going to be focusing on the government legislation that we need to get through before the end of the term. So those are the things that we've already agreed on, whether it's in our coalition agreement or whether it's the work programmes that have just been carrying on in the background. Those are the things that I think will be like business as usual. We're making sure that we're all united and going forward on. And as you get closer to the election, I think you'll see the differences between the parties. And I mean, maybe we're seeing some of that happening now. But, you know, we're out there to win an election and win votes. And so there will be differences between us at times. But I think overall, I'm really surprised and also really happy that this government has been able to work so well together, given that we are three different parties with three, you know, quite distinctly different identities. But there's quite a lot that we do agree on. So I just think we need to make sure that we focus on that to get that business through. And then, yeah, look, we'll be obviously coming out with some of our policies that are different to each other, so people know, you know, what is the difference here and who can we vote for and, you know, where does my values align to most.
That was the ACT Party's Laura McClure speaking to me about ACT's stance on the US kidnapping of Venezuelan President Maduro and the party's plans for the 2026 election.
That was our weekly chat with the ACT Party.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. Text in your thoughts 5395.
I believe in like the solar system. I believe in space. I really do believe in space.
Spaced Out. Josh Auraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday.
Garth, Garth, where's your hat? No hat, no play.
I don't have one, sir.
Then go on and pick a hat from Lost Property.
Oh, sir, those hats all have nits.
It's nits or melanoma, Garth.
It's a no-hat, no-play summer, so it's lucky 95BFM have you sorted with sweet merch for your noggins. Choose from four designs, two classic cap designs, one cord design, and a bucket hat. Pre-order yours now from twotonesmerch.co.nz.
The worms better watch their back.
Sometimes you need a bit of uns.
That snooze button better be disarmed.
I like it. It's making my eyelid twitch. Love it.
And the wrong side of the bed better shuffle over.
And they're just so beautifully, like, menstrual.
Because we've got a little something for your gratitude journal.
Cowbella. 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 Cowbella.
It's the 95BFM Breakfast Show with your hosts, Rosetta and Millie. 7 till 10 every weekday. Thanks to 8:30 Coffee Roasters.
Once I made a dream. First of all, oh, I love it. I've clearly given up on trying to have any sort of neutrality in this interview.
The Wire. That was Enough by Fables. Welcome back to The Wire on 95 BFM. After months of allegedly anti-narcotic hostilities in the Caribbean around Venezuela, at the beginning of this year, the United States, under President Trump, struck the country directly and kidnapped Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The incursion has been justified by the US on account of accusations of narco-terrorism, with the US angling for regime change. As this comes to a head, however, discussions have re-emerged around the role that the US should play as a geopolitical power in South America and the Western Hemisphere as a whole. I spoke to Professor Robert Patman, a senior lecturer in political science at the University of Otago, about the attack and what this means for Trump's plans in the area. For starters, what have we actually seen here from the US?
What we've seen from the US is an intervention in Venezuela. It falls short of regime change, but Mr. Trump has effectively said, of having abducted the head of state, Nicolas Maduro, and his partner, his wife, and brought them to New York to face justice, U.S. justice, Mr. Trump has done two things. Firstly, he said that he will effectively run the country until there are conditions for what he calls a safe transition of power. And secondly, he's opened discussions. In fact, he met with U.S. Oil company executives on Saturday, which, according to Mr. Trump's vision, which will allow U.S. companies, amongst the largest oil companies in the world, to access Venezuela's oil. It should be pointed out to our listeners that Venezuela has the world's largest known oil reserves, but its oil industry has been floundering recently. So, in a sense, Mr. Trump claims he will run Venezuela in the interim. So what we've seen here is U.S. intervention. What is quite clear also is that unilaterally removing Maduro from power means that the U.S. has violated its own laws, as federal laws, as well as international law. In the case of Venezuela, there was no threat to the national security of the United States. So I suppose, to answer your question, what we've seen is the application of the principle that might is right to Venezuela. My own sense is that, on the evidence of what we've seen so far, although it's led to triumphalism within some of Mr. Trump's supporters, this could lead to severe blowback problems to the United States, both in Venezuela, but also internationally.
And looking at the justification that the Trump administration has given for this incursion, do those justifications hold much validity, or are they inconsistent with what we've seen from the US here?
Well, those charges against Nicolas Maduro and the claims made before he was detained will now be tested in the US court system in New York. And, of course, it's not preordained that the administration will be successful in their legal actions against Maduro. He's on mainly drug-related charges, as well as the possession of weapons, which seems a bit odd. And one or two legal commentators have suggested that the administration may have its work cut out actually winning the legal case against Maduro in New York. And so that's an interesting sort of sidebar in itself. With respect to your deeper question, to what extent are these charges justified? I've got to be quite clear here. Venezuela is a country in which is run by an authoritarian, has been run by an authoritarian state, and probably is not averse to boosting its economy, is struggling, and is not averse to getting additional resources through sometimes involvement in international criminal activities. Having said that, it's not the biggest cause or the biggest exporter of drugs to the United States by a very long way. China and also in Mexico are responsible for transmitting or having hosting groups or linked to groups which transmit drugs like fentanyl, which is something which is a major concern for Mr. Trump. But Mr. Trump seems to be focusing on the symptoms rather than the cause of the problem. The cause of the drug problem, of course, is that there's many Americans who are able and willing to buy these drugs. And because there's a demand for these drugs in the United States, there's no shortage of people happy to try to help satisfy that demand and make a lot of money in the process. So in short, I'm not sure that Venezuela's relatively low-level involvement in the drug market would justify overthrowing and detaining a head of state of another country.
And just to pivot slightly, looking at both the actions of the Trump administration in the lead-up to this event, but also kind of the wider geopolitical posturing of particularly this administration, could we have seen this coming? Is this par for the course with their current geopolitical avenues, or is this kind of a shock pivot to a more aggressive tactic?
No, it's not a shock pivot. It's fully in keeping with the position that the United States has taken since Trump returned to the White House. In December, the Trump administration published something called the National Security Document or Statement, and that outlines, it was published, as I say, the National Security Strategy. Amongst other things, the strategy indicated the U.S. wished to reestablish its dominance in the Western Hemisphere, a sort of updated version of the 1823 Monroe Doctrine, which was a sort of 19th century U.S. strategy of protecting its position in South America from rival European countries at the time. In short, the spheres of influence was outlined in the national security approach that was published. And if you look at America's actions since Trump returned to office, in his first 9 months, he's taken the view that he's taken the side of Mr. Putin in the dispute with Ukraine following Putin's illegal invasion of Ukraine. that horrifies most liberal democracies, because effectively the most powerful country in the world is siding with the aggressor against the victim of aggression. And so Mr. Trump has basically taken a position in the, you know, throughout the first 10, 11 months of the administration, where basically he's shown little respect for the rules-based international order. And the action that he's taken in Venezuela confirms that he's serious about his vision of international relations. What is his vision of international relations? Mr. Trump has no time for international institutions or multilateralism, something which New Zealand believes in, both in the UN and also in the rule of law. I mean, that's crucial for most small and middle powers. But he doesn't believe in that. He believes in a sort of global hierarchy, a concert of power, a concert of great powers. And in that document I just referred to, published by the US government in December last year, Mr. Trump explicitly outlines a vision for the world in his era being run by five great powers. The United States would sit at top of the table, along with China and Russia and India and Japan. There'll be little room at that table for the likes of New Zealand, or indeed Canada, Australia, or middle powers, or indeed most European countries. So this is a radically different approach. This is a major departure from any position taken by the US presidency, or US president, I should say, in the post-45 era. So Mr. Trump has broken with the past. He's now advocating a sort of back-to-the-future perspective of international relations, which in many respects parallels the 19th century concert of great powers that effectively presided over European security in the 19th century. The question is, will Mr. Trump's vision fit with the 21st century, where you have many more countries than you did in the 19th century, and virtually all of those countries, however small, jealously guard their sovereignty and their national interests? And it does not look like a good fit to me.
Can we see this as a sort of a statement of intent, or starting as Trump means to continue with his eyes on this geopolitical hierarchy, can we expect to see more weaponization of force throughout both South America and the rest of the world going forth?
If we are to believe the rhetoric of the administration, we must prepare ourselves for that possibility. Mr. Trump seems to be in heady form since overthrowing Maduro. And he has already warned Cuba. Cuba largely imported oil from Venezuela. And since America now has effectively taken over control of Venezuela's oil industry, has warned Cuba that they will have to deal with the United States from now on. They will have to make a deal. He's also threatened the leadership of neighboring Colombia. Colombia is a neighbor of Venezuela. He's also threatening to annex Greenland. And earlier in his presidency, the United States threatened to invade Canada as well.
That was the University of Otago's Robert Patman on the US intervention in Venezuela and how it reflects Trump's plans for America.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
2025 saw the highest rise in ocean temperatures since modern measurements began, marking a worrying increase in the pace of the climate crisis. Ocean temperature measurements are one of the most accurate measures of climate change and have significant impacts on multiple ecological factors, including weather. To discuss rising ocean temperatures and what they mean for the world, I spoke to one of the authors on the paper discussing the findings, distinguished scholar at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, and honorary faculty member at the Department of Physics at the University of Auckland, Kevin Tremberth, about rising ocean temperatures and the potential ramifications. I began by asking how it is that we record the temperatures in the ocean.
Well, the analysis that the group that I'm associated with does is of all of the data in the especially in the top 2,000 meters of the ocean. So it's not just at the surface, although we do the surface as well. It's the top two kilometers of the ocean. And so that is taking advantage of special kinds of observations that are made to sample that particular region. But there, you know, are thousands of them throughout the year made by about 50 different countries, including New Zealand, throughout the world, using a technology called Argo floats. These are devices that are autonomous. They are launched from a ship, and they reside about 1 kilometer depth, and they drop down to 2 kilometers depth. They have an inflatable chamber, which it can either fill up with water or empty. And when it fills it up with water, it goes down to 2 kilometers, and then it pops up to the surface when it pumps the water out, and it takes temperature and salinity measurements through the top 2 kilometers. And then when it gets to the surface, it radios that information back to ground-based stations. And so that's all compiled. And then it has to be, of course, quality controlled. And it's quite an involved procedure. But there are something like 3,800 or so of these floats deployed at any time. So there's an observation about every 300 kilometers or so.
And what kind of temperatures did we end up seeing last year?
So 2025 turns out to be the warmest year on record by quite a substantial amount. And, you know, we measure it in terms of joules, which is a unit of energy, and it's a little hard to relate that directly, but it turns out to be about 200 times all of the energy that all of the electricity that was used around the world in the same year, in the same period. So it's a huge amount of energy. And it comes about because of the increasing greenhouse gases, in particular carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that are trapping the sun's radiation in the climate system. And that energy ends up in the ocean. And so the ocean temperatures turn out to be the best single measure we have that climate change is occurring.
And how exactly does ocean warming work? Like, is it literally the whole ocean getting hotter, or is there a bit more to it than that?
Well, there's quite a lot more to it, because the ocean is quite strongly stratified. You know, the top part of the ocean is much warmer than the very deep ocean, and in fact, the very deep ocean is, only just a degree or two above freezing point, although the freezing point is complicated because it's saline. So the freezing point is actually below 0 degrees Celsius. And so the warm water sits on top of cold water. That means it's hard for heat to penetrate. And the main way it does it is by winds mixing and by tides and by ocean currents. And all of that helps to mix the heat gradually down. But it takes 25 years for the heat to go from the surface down to around 2 kilometer depth. And so most of the heat is in the upper layers, and the greatest warming is right near the surface.
How do these temperatures compare to those in the past, you know, not just the years before, but also, you know, 50 to 100 years ago?
Well, there wasn't very much warming, as far as we are aware of, up until about the 1960s or thereabouts. And the main warming that is really evident begins in the late 1970s in the upper layers. And it really is only detectable about 2 kilometers depth after about 2005. We don't have really good measurements a long way back. And so that statement is based upon the measurements that do exist. The strongest measurements are the best coverage of measurements is after about 2000.
And you mentioned earlier that the ocean temperature is a good measure for climate change. How important is the temperature of the ocean, not just as a measurement of climate change, but also, you know, for the animals living in it, for people? How does this temperature impact us and the rest of the world?
Yes, so it's interesting how the heat actually gets into the ocean. And of course, some of it occurs just because the sun is shining on the top of the ocean and the ocean warms up. But it doesn't stay there. It actually circulates around in the atmosphere, and it takes a few years for it to actually stabilize and really get buried deeply enough in the ocean for it to stay there. And then, as I say, it gradually permeates further and further down. But and so what happens is some of it evaporates, or there's evaporative cooling of the ocean, and moisture evaporates into the atmosphere. That moisture then gets caught up in storms, and then it gets rained out. And in the process, the heat that went into the evaporation of the ocean gets caught up in storms, and that makes the storms more vigorous. It rains harder as a consequence, and we're seeing that. There's more extreme weather events as a consequence. We've seen quite a lot of that in New Zealand in December in particular, and early January. A lot of squally storms, and that's partly because in the New Zealand area, the sea surface temperatures are particularly warm as well.
What can, you know, governments around the world be doing? Obviously, there's a lot of attention in many places towards acting on climate change. Are the current efforts enough, and what more can be done, I guess, to improve this and reverse these effects?
Yeah, well, this is turning out to be a major issue because of the United States and the way in which they're dropping out of taking good measurements and analyzing them. This is one of the things about the record that we've compiled for the last year, is that the U.S. Participation has been a lot less. And, just yesterday there was an announcement that the U.S. was leaving the UNFCCC, the Framework Convention on Climate Change. That's the convention which was signed by 198 countries, including New Zealand, all around the world. And it's an agreement that says that each country will make measurements and estimates of emissions and report those. And that's one of the ways in which we find out, you know, how much carbon dioxide is going into the atmosphere and where it is coming from. And so the basic measurements are actually in jeopardy, and this is a big issue. And then what do we do about it? Well, we try to decarbonize the economy and cut down on the emissions, the burning of fossil fuels of various kinds, and driving electric cars, for instance, instead of internal combustion engine cars, and burning things. And so those efforts have been underway, especially since the Paris Agreement in 2017 around the world. I must say New Zealand is not doing very well in the last year or two. They were doing reasonably well up till that point. And as a result, climate change is continuing, and the changes in the ocean heat content is actually the best single measurement that the climate change is happening. And so if we're not going to stop it from happening, then we need to recognize that it's happening and prepare for it. And so I think in New Zealand, there could be a lot more preparation for that kind of thing. And a lot of it in New Zealand relates to preparing for heavy rains and flooding. And we've seen, you know, many examples of that, most recently in the Nelson area, but many other parts of the country in recent years. In other parts of the world, it's not only flooding, but also the heat waves and wildfires that occur. And Australia is suffering from that at the moment, for instance. And so climate change is an important issue. We need to be able to track it and decide, you know, better just what to do about it.
That was distinguished scholar at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, and honorary faculty member at the Department of Physics at the University of Auckland, Kevin Trenberth, speaking to me about rising ocean temperatures and the ramifications. We'll be right back. Text in 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
I'm not gonna die on this hill, or maybe I will. Summer's over, it's sad, but I'm still burning bad. Can't keep calling it grief, or hoping it's brief when you live in the world. But I live underneath, who will water the plants? Are they just gonna be another thing that dies from spinning time around me?
I seem like such a bitch. I found a crouton underneath the futon. Mama said I couldn't eat it, cause all my teeth are gone. My personality is based on food now. Take a phone book down. He's my veterinarian. His folks are from Croatia. They've been through some shit. And I seem like such a bitch when I talk about Swedish politics.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
That was Heartbreak for Jet Lag by Vera Ellen and Uno 2 by Viagra Boys. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Over the New Year period, Manage My Health, a platform and portal used by many GPs and health practitioners across New Zealand, was subject to a data breach by hackers. Around 125,000 New Zealanders were affected, with fears of scams, identity theft, and fraud growing with the leak of their personal details and information. While Manage My Health claimed their security was sufficient, there still remains the question of why the platform was targeted as an easy enough target. I spoke to Senior Lecturer in Computer Science at the University of Auckland, Dr. Ulrich Speidel, about the data breach, how these hackers work, and why health data was able to be accessed and leaked. Just to get us started, what actually was this hack? How did these people get this data?
Okay, so we don't actually have a lot of details, and that's probably good in the sense that when you're actually defending against a breach like this. I mean, one of the things is you know that hackers have been inside your systems. What you don't know is necessarily what they've done there. So, you know, obviously in this case they've stolen data. But the other thing, of course, is that often when, you know, people intrude into systems like this, one of the things that they install is they install backdoors, and then, you know, a lot of cases multiple backdoors, so they're able to get back in again afterwards, right? So, and so when you're responding to something like this, one of the tasks is to basically look at the system and find out, okay, you know, which backdoors, if any, have been installed, and try to shut those backdoors down. And the more you sort of publicly divulge as to what you know about what's happened to a system like this, the more you assist the hacker to basically know what you know about their activities, and that's you know, can be a bit tricky from time to time, in the sense that that may well alert them to the fact that there's backdoors that they put in there that you haven't discovered yet, and where you're not sitting and watching. They came in through the front door, which probably means through a compromised password. Either somebody used a very weak password that was then, you know, guessed by the hackers with brute force, or somebody was tricked with a phishing email. One of the administrator team was tricked with a phishing email into, you know, logging in from a compromised system or something like this, that would have then literally served themselves, the hackers, the password on the server platter. But we don't really know what happened there. Only Manage My Health and whoever they contracted in order to assist them with it would be aware of this.
Do we know if this maybe was a consequence of a weak sort of security measure, or is there really no way to tell about the strength of the cybersecurity for companies like MyHealth?
Well, it's certainly the fact that they were able to get in certainly tells us a little bit about this, because, I mean, essentially what you have to remember, hackers who do this sort of thing basically run this as a business. And they go to whichever organization they perceive to be the most weakly protected with the highest possible yield. In other words, which organization is most likely to pay ransom, or, you know, to pay up, or, you know, where can we most likely, gain from intruding. And so generally they single out organizations that, you know, basically, you know, and, you know, what they do is they go and they sniff around, they scan a little bit. So they look, for example, they go and connect to the website and they have a look and see, okay, you know, which version of the web server are they running? Is this the current version, or is this one that's maybe a year or two old and hasn't been patched? And so they look at this and then they basically say, okay, you know, maybe this is something that hasn't been patched in a while. So at that point, they look at it and they say, okay, well, you know, that probably means that they're not really good at, you know, patching their software up to the latest level. So let's see what they're running and let's see, you know, what the known vulnerabilities in that piece of software are. And there's typically exploits and exploit kits out there that people can use in order to then intrude into systems like that. And that's what they will then typically do. And, you know, one of these things, for example, may have been that they've noticed that they're relying on a lot of email notifications and stuff like this. So they thought, okay, well, maybe, you know, a good way in is to basically just, you know, send an email notification that looks like it's, if it's coming from them, to somebody who, you know, should know how to, you know, how to log in, or something along those lines. So there's often more than one way to attack an organization like this, and it really depends on, you know, how important security is handled within their operational teams. A lot of the time what we see is that people who actually run systems like that, for them the most important thing is to keep it running and to basically make sure that the next feature and the next deliverable is there, you know, really, really quickly. But often that is done at the expense of keeping the software secure and keeping things, you know, nice and tight and reviewed. And that's often where then sort of a lax culture creeps in, because, you know, you're a commercial company, you have to turn over, you know, business. And so often it's what the software is meant to do and what the site is meant to do, rather than what it's not meant to do, that goes to the forefront. You know, basically, often it's possible to kind of sniff culture like this a bit from a distance if you're a professional hacker and you're doing this this for a living. So for all practical purposes, I think that that's actually what may have happened here, that, you know, basically they just went looking and, you know, then saw weaknesses and decided that's... that's a company that's got literally hundreds of thousands of, you know, clients out there, you know, all of whom have skin in the game. And so therefore, they were probably a very, very lucrative target to go and approach about a ransom.
And other than the obvious value of this data for the hackers, what does it mean for New Zealanders who use the software that their personal data may have been accessed and leaked?
Yeah, as has been pointed out, you know, quite widely in the media, there's, you know, potentially, you know, huge, huge repercussions. I mean, you know, think about, you know, situations where, for example, you know, you have a, you know, young woman who goes and, you know, consults their GP about an abortion, right? And, you know, say she's coming from a background where abortions are, you know, frowned upon. And the last thing, you know, that she would want is their community to find out. And so, you know, basically with a leak like this, a community might find out, or it might be possible to then go and sort of say, hey, you know, I've looked through their data. I notice you've had an abortion, whatever, 2-3 years ago. And, you know, what are you willing to do? You know, how much are you willing to pay? So we're not going to tell your parents or your pastor or whoever, right? And, you know, this is just one of many, 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 you know, ways in which that sort of thing, you know, can be abused. I mean, there'd be other things, you know, imagine, you know, somebody in a professional position, you know, consulting a GP about, say, an alcohol dependency or something like this, and that sort of coming, and that sort of thing coming out that could, you know, lead to the person losing their job. So there's lots and lots and lots and lots of potential repercussions from this. And, you know, whenever there's repercussions, obviously, there's the potential for their data to then, you know, be, you know, abused for blackmail. The other thing, of course, that's, you know, also a bit of a concern is, even if it's just simple personal data like date of birth and addresses and that sort of stuff, then, you know, basically at that point, you know, often this is the sort of data that people will use for verification on anything like bank accounts and, you know, obviously things like power accounts and water accounts, and you know, basically whenever you're wanting to apply for credit with anyone, that's the first piece of information somebody else wants in. You know, what's your address, what's your date of birth, where have you previously lived, da 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 da, those things. And having that information out there makes it much, much easier to basically obtain an advantage or default by impersonation. And obviously, if somebody, walks through the door of the bank and pretends to be you, then having that information about you obviously makes it much, much easier for them to access their bank, access your bank account.
And with all that said and done, what sort of changes should we be seeing either in policies or changes in tax from companies like MyHealth and in the wider space in order to kind of meet their responsibility to their users around that data staying private?
Okay, so what I would really like to see is, people, and this is especially the people who sort of in the management functions, that when they actually go and they say, hey, I'd really like to have this feature and, manage my health, and, we'd now like to be able to, for example, and I guess they've already had that, I'm not a manage my health user, luckily, I suppose, but, say, for example, you wanted to have a new feature that allowed you to communicate with your GP about this or about that. And that the thing that I would like to see at that point is that when people are putting that feature in, that rather than just seeing a wish list of what that feature is going to look like and, all the great and exciting things it's going to do, that there'd be an equal weight being put on what it's not going to do and what it's not going to expose and what it's not going to be allowing users, be they legitimate or illegitimate ones, to do and discover. And that means that, for example, every developer that they're putting onto the task really needs to have had some training onto how to avoid the most common pitfalls when interfacing web interface to middleware and database behind it, just give people a bit of an idea what's actually required in order to keep something like that safe. And there's a lot of technical stuff involved there. That's probably going to go over the head of most of your audience, but the thing is, the developers involved in this, they shouldn't just be aware of it. It's also that they need to be given the time and the space and the resource to actually implement those security measures and to make sure that, security isn't always falling by the wayside in the name of expediency. And this is unfortunately something that happens still all too often in application developments, and this is why we're seeing problems like this.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Ulrich Speidel on the Manage My Health Data Breach, what it means for cybersecurity and what it means for our data.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Laura McClure, Distinguished Scholar at the National Centre for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, Kevin Trenberth. The University of Otago's Robert Patman. And the University of Auckland's Dr. Ulrich Speidel. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.